And so it begins. Several decades ago, former Deputy Director of Central Intelligence Victor Marchetti enriched the public vocabulary of dissimulation with the expression limited hangout. That's a term of art in espionage and intelligence circles that Marchetti defined as follows. When the veil of secrecy is shredded and they can no longer rely on a phony cover story to misinform the public, they resort to admitting, sometimes even volunteering, some of the truth, while still managing to withhold the key and damaging facts in the case. The public, however, is usually so intrigued by the new information that it never thinks to pursue the matter any further. That strategy was embraced by the Nixon White House during a tape-recorded May 22, 1973 conversation involving Richard Nixon, John Dean, and John Ehrlichman, discussing what they were going to do in order to immunize the president, to shield the Oval Office from disclosures regarding the Watergate break-in and the attendant crimes. Ehrlichman proposed what he called a modified limited hangout, in which they would concede what was no longer deniable, and then put the most self-exculpatory spin on it, create a document that would be shared with sympathetic members of the Special Committee investigating Watergate on Capitol Hill, and use press leaks in order to massage the public impression of what was being discussed. This is precisely what is going on now in Bonneville County with respect to the unjust conviction of Christopher Conley Tapp for the June 1996 murder of Angie Dodge. That is a crime he did not commit. There is no evidence beyond a coerced false confession that was extorted from Mr. Tapp through a process of psychological torture to suggest that he had anything to do whatsoever with this crime. 14 months in the making, and with a $36,000 price tag, Twin Falls private investigator Stuart Robinson's report investigating the 1997 murder conviction of Chris Tapp has been released by the Bonneville County Prosecutor's Office, reported the Idaho Falls Post-Register on September 9th. Robinson concludes that Tapp's confession to involvement in the killing of Angie Dodge, the 18-year-old woman whose murder has kept him behind bars for nearly half his life, was, quote, either tainted, questionable, or unlikely. This is something that most observers of this case had concluded years ago. Robinson's report points to no other evidence that Tapp was involved in the murder. Robinson does conclude that Tapp was a witness to the crime, a conclusion disputed by other investigators who say that the new report does not change their original assessment. Having read this report this morning, I agree with the assessment provided by the critics of Mr. Robinson. There is nothing in that report beyond speculation about things that Tapp said that were ambiguous in the video-recorded interrogations to connect him to this crime in any way. It's pretty clear that he was the subject of what we might call investigatory ventriloquism. He was simply reciting what he had been told to say by armed strangers who had him helpless and vulnerable in captivity in circumstances where he was being told that if he didn't cooperate, he might very well face the electric chair. Robinson, in my opinion, knowing that he had to produce something to placate the people who had just paid him $36,000 in funds seized from tax victims in Bonneville County, provided the prosecutor's office with the thinnest of slender reeds upon which to repose their hopes for what would likely be some kind of deal in which Tapp might accept something along the lines of a post-conviction plea bargain. This case is almost certainly headed for a new trial. I think that the Bonneville County Prosecutor's Office, for that matter, the political establishment in Idaho Falls and Bonneville County in general, want to avoid this. I think that what is going to happen is that they're going to try to find some way of avoiding a new trial by striking a deal with Christopher Tapp, who has been in prison now for almost 20 years. At this time, no decisions or conclusions have been made by this office as to the content and or impact of this report, but we will continue to review and analyze the report and wait for feedback from the Idaho Falls Police Department, TAP's defense attorney, and Judges for Justice, Prosecutor Danny Clark wrote in a news release. The report contains many serious criticisms of the Idaho Falls Police Department's handling of the case, including findings that detectives seriously compromised the investigation by feeding TAP non-public information about the crime, showing him crime scene photos, and even making an unrecorded trip with him to the crime scene. All of this has been covered in numerous appeals that have been filed by TAP over the last decade or longer. Most of this was covered in the Judges for Justice report, an examination of the conviction and the investigation that led to the conviction. And quite a bit of this has been reported by myself in two previous radio programs and also in two articles I've written for Pro Libertate. There's nothing here, in other words, that has not been put into the public domain. The difference is that this is a report that was paid for by the prosecutors as part of this modified limited hangout strategy. Now, the prosecution will probably continue to claim that TAP is an accessory to the crime, or he was an accomplice in the crime, and they will try to persuade the public that he has spent roughly 20 years in prison covering for the actual murderer. In his report, Robinson said that some actions taken by police during the interrogations were unethical, and I think that that does not exaggerate the gravity of their offenses. I would say that they were flatly criminal. There's solid evidence provided in this report and in previous investigations that the lead investigator, Jared Furman, flat out perjured himself on the witness stand. He was asked directly about whether he had provided non-public information to Christopher Tapp. The report, commissioned by prosecutors, doesn't point to any evidence that Tapp participated in the murder. The only evidence of that was Tapp's confession, the report states, and that confession was too contaminated by detectives to be reliable. From reviewing investigative reports, interviews, and trial transcripts, the charges stem largely from Tapp's own statements, which, from analysis, prove that most of his statements as to his personal involvement were questionable, the report states. If they're questionable, of course, they fall below the threshold of proving a crime beyond a reasonable doubt. Tapp specifically confessed that he slashed Dodge's breast after the other alleged participants in the murder threatened him. The report finds that story was suggested to him by Detective Steve Finn, the polygrapher, and that it doesn't match the physical evidence at the scene. Tapp confessed that he cut Dodge while her shirt was pulled up, the report states, but there is a slash on her shirt that precisely matches the place where she was slashed across the breast, indicating that her shirt was pulled down. The report also raises questions about whether police gave truthful testimony during the trial. The report notes that then-Detective Jared Furman, who would go on to serve as mayor of Idaho Falls, and who suddenly developed a congenital problem with memory, once he was called upon to testify in a post-conviction hearing a number of years ago. Furman testified at trial that Tapp wasn't given any specific information about the crime by police, but Robinson found that Tapp was provided numerous details during his interrogation about the crime and the crime scene, which should have been withheld by the detectives, and the jury never saw the full 20 hours of interrogations and polygraph sessions during which Tapp was fed these details, including that a knife was used in the murder, that Dodge was killed at night, and that a teddy bear was likely used to muffle her screams. An interviewer should never disclose to a subject any facts of the crime, especially what type of weapon was used, Robinson wrote. Robinson also found that detectives broke from sound investigative procedure by repeatedly telling Tapp that he would face the gas chamber. Finally, Robinson said that a jury might have had a hard time concluding that Tapp participated in the murder, given that there are numerous DNA samples at the crime scene, none of which matches Tapp. What the prosecutor's office is doing once again is it's pursuing the modified limited hangout strategy. They will admit what has been documented, they will obfuscate what is still in dispute, they will obstruct, delay, and dissimulate. Eventually, they're going to try to do a deal to preserve some colorable claim that they did something other than frame an innocent man for murder and steal 20 years of his life in the process. I will have a great deal to say about that when I return. This is Will Grigg with Freedom Zealot Radio and the Liberty News Radio Network. Please stand by for more sedition after this.
Office is finalizing hiring an independent investigator to look into the 1996 Angie Dodge murder case. Since he was convicted of the murder, various advocacy groups have questioned Christopher Tapp's guilt.
The prosecutor says he wants to bring in somebody who will look at everything. Some groups have looked into things like Tapp's confession. Others have looked into things like DNA. The prosecutor says this investigator will look at all of it.
There's been court after court that has reviewed this case. The same questions that are being raised by these groups now have been reviewed by the courts over the last 18 years to instill in the public confidence in what's been done.
Bonneville County Prosecutor Danny Clark explained that the purpose of the outside investigation of the Christopher Tapp conviction for the murder of Angie Dodge in June of 1996 by private investigator and retired Blackfoot Police Department Detective Stuart M. Robison, who is also, by the way, an instructor at the Idaho Peace Officer Standards and Training Academy, is, quote, to instill in the public confidence in what has been done. They're not seeking to learn the truth, but rather to validate and sustain the system and those who preside over it, because, as Clark said, court after court has examined this case and upheld the conviction. To challenge the conviction of Christopher Tapp, to demonstrate that he was wrongfully accused, wrongfully prosecuted, that his confession was extorted from him through psychological manipulation that has been described by competent professionals as torture, to demonstrate and accept all of that would be to indict the entire criminal justice system, such as it is, of Bonneville County and indeed the state of Idaho, because the appellate courts have all ratified this conviction. So the purpose of Robison's investigation, such as it was, it is an outside investigation, not an independent one, given this man's professional connections. The purpose was to admit the irrefutable and cling to any molecular-level pretense of competence and honesty on the part of the people who convicted Christopher Tapp. It's useful, I think, to review how this case was tried in 1998. Prosecutors presented their first evidence to the jury Thursday, implicating Christopher C. Tapp in the murder of 18-year-old Angie Dodge, reported the Idaho Falls Post-Register on May 15th of 1998. Tapp is accused of holding Dodge down while two other men raped her. Then one of them, Benjamin Hobbs, note that his name is being put in circulation in the trial, while one of them, Benjamin Hobbs, allegedly slit her throat in the early morning hours of June 13th, 1996. At the time, Hobbs was not even in custody. By the way, police arrested Tapp in connection with the murder in January 1997. During videotaped interviews with police, Tapp admitted he was involved in Dodge's murder. That isn't true. This was wrung from him under the threat of murder, that is to say, that he would be sent to the gas chamber if he didn't provide his captors with the information they were seeking to incriminate Benjamin Hobbs. During the second day of testimony, 18-year-old Destiny R. Osborne said she was at a party a few days after Dodge's murder and overheard a conversation in which Tapp and Hobbs talked about killing Dodge. In that conversation, Tapp said he held Dodge while two other people raped her. Tapp also said that he stabbed Dodge, she said, that is to say Destiny Osborne. Tapp said Hobbs slit Dodge's throat, according to Osborne. The comments Osborne said she overheard at the party are similar to statements the videotape show Tapp making to the police. The men killed Dodge because she owed them money for methamphetamine, Osborne said. According to the autopsy and the toxicology report, there was no evidence of drugs of any kind in Angie Dodge's system at the time she was murdered. Under cross-examination, Osborne said Jeremy Sargas also talked about taking part in the murder. Referring to page 40 of the Robeson report on the extorted false confession of Christopher Tapp, we read the following. January 17, 1997, Detective Furman has learned that the DNA found at the crime scene doesn't match Tapp or Hobbs. Detective Furman starts to question Tapp if Jeremy Sargas could have also been in the apartment when Angie was killed. Tapp is given another polygraph by Detective Stephen Finn on January 18, 1997. During this pre-polygraph exam, Detective Finn asked Tapp who else was in the apartment with him and Hobbs. Tapp said, "Some guy, I remember somebody else being there. I have to remember. Why? He has to remember in order to save his own life." Continuing now on page 41 of the Robeson Report. Tapp continues with, maybe Jer was. Jeremy, put Jer there. This is a name that had been suggested to him by his captors. Tapp also said he was speculating that Jer was there, so I'm going to go with yes on that. Robeson comments, Tapp is not saying Jeremy Sargas is in Angie's apartment. Detective Finn should have stopped Tapp and told him that he needed to know if Jeremy was there, yes or no, before continuing with the polygraph exam. Detective Finn would have known by Tapp's response that he was going to get a failed polygraph test. Instead, Detective Finn proceeds with the test, and Tapp answered yes to Jeremy Sargas being in the apartment when Angie was killed. At the conclusion of the test, Detective Finn tells Tapp that he is 100% truthful when he said that Jeremy Sargas was in Angie's apartment. Continuing now on page 42, Detective Furman was the one that introduced Sargas as a suspect, even when Tapp denied this. Detective Finn assisted in convincing Tapp that he, Tapp, was telling the truth when he stated that Sargas was in Angie's apartment when she was killed. It was after the polygraph by Finn that Tapp believed Sargas was involved in the murder of Angie. He did not sua sponte name Jeremy Sargas as one of the perpetrators. This was suggested to him by Furman, and then this story was validated by Steve Finn, who was pretending to administer a polygraph exam. By the time the trial began, in May of 1998, it was known to the point of a moral certainty that Sargas had been excluded as a suspect on the basis of the physical evidence. And yet, the prosecutor, Kip Manwaring, was the lead prosecutor in this case, and the detectives who built the case allowed Destiny R. Osborne to offer perjured testimony about a purported conversation that would have placed both Benjamin Hobbs and Jeremy Sargas on the scene as the likely perpetrators of this murder. Prosecutors later dropped charges against Sargas, the Post Register reported, when tests showed his DNA did not match physical evidence found in Dodge's apartment, according to statements made by Bonneville County Prosecutor Kip Manwaring at earlier court hearings. Booker tried to discredit Osborne's testimony after she admitted she was addicted to drugs around the time of the murder and that she was high when she overheard the conversation between Tapp and Hobbs. When Booker asked if the jury should believe her, even though she admitted she was high, Osborne responded that she didn't care what the jury thought. "I know what I heard," she said. "I'm here so Angie can rest in peace." The prosecutors, in allowing Osborne's testimony, were committing misprison of perjury. They had known by this time that Sargas was not on the scene and that Hobbs was not on the scene, which means that what Destiny R. Osborne was saying about this purported conversation at a party where she was blitzed on methamphetamine could not have been true, yet they allowed this into the record. They allowed the jury to hear this testimony as a way of buttressing what they knew was a false confession. There's something else that's peculiar about Jeremy Sargas. This is from the February 5th, 1997 Post Register. Tapp's friend, Jeremy Sargas, 18, of Idaho Falls, was also arrested and charged with being an accessory to a felony related to Dodge's murder. He was released by court order from the Bonneville County Jail Friday, according to the jail administration. Manwaring said the release was made due to a request from his family, who wanted to get him into treatment. Manwaring did not know what kind of treatment or counseling Sargas is undergoing. Efforts to reach Sargas's family had been unsuccessful. And yet, within a year, they were allowing testimony in the Chris Tapp prosecution that placed him on the scene as one of the perpetrators of the murder. He was never charged. I'll be back in just a minute. The jury Tuesday heard Christopher C. Tapp give detectives a series of conflicting stories about the rape and murder of 18-year-old Angie Dodge, reported the Post-Register of Idaho Falls on May 20th of 1998, describing the trial of Mr. Tapp for that murder. Prosecutors continued showing portions of the nearly 30 hours of videotaped interviews police conducted with Tapp to the nine women and three men who will decide if he participated in the June 13, 1996 murder. In a tape the jury saw Monday, Tapp said he didn't know anything about the murder or if Benjamin Hobbs had killed Dodge. Welcome back, by the way, to Freedom Is All at Radio. I am William Grigg, the author and proprietor of the Pro Libertate blog, which you can find at freedominourtime.blogspot.com. There's a PayPal button at the right-hand margin of the page and at the bottom of every essay. I would really appreciate your help. Police focused on Hobbs and his friends, including Tapp, after Hobbs was arrested in Ely, Nevada, for attacking a woman there in an interview conducted on January 10th of 1997, 3 days after police first questioned him. Tapp provided a written statement indicating Hobbs said he had killed Dodge. In a later videotaped interview, which the jury has not seen, Tapp tells police that he held Dodge while Hobbs and another man he knew only as Mike raped her, and then Hobbs cut her throat. Hobbs has never been charged in the crime, and throughout the trial, the prosecution has produced no physical evidence putting Hobbs at the murder scene. That's because Hobbs wasn't there. Neither was Jeremy Sargas, and neither was Christopher Tapp. Referring once again to Stuart Robeson's $36,000 taxpayer-subsidized special investigation of the Christopher Tapp conviction that was carried out at the behest of, and presumably for the benefit of, the Bonneville Prosecutor's Office. On page 17, describing the January 7th, 1997 interrogation of Christopher Tapp, we read the following. Detective Furman, that's Jared Furman, the lead investigator, informed Tapp that he, Tapp, is involved to some degree in the murder of Angie, and that he, meaning Tapp, needs to acknowledge that involvement. Detective Furman also tells Tapp that he, Tapp, could be charged with first-degree murder. Detective Furman followed this statement with, "Did Ben intend to kill her?" There is an implicit quid pro quo in that question. Give us evidence against Ben, meaning Ben Hobbs, and you will be spared the gas chamber. Tapp responded, whispering, "No, no." When Tapp answered this question, he is also shaking his head from side to side. Detective Furman then followed this with, "Was it a spur-of-the-moment thing?" Tapp doesn't answer verbally, but in the video, he is shaking his head up and down in the affirmative. At this point, knowing that his only chance of avoiding execution is to find something that will placate his captors, at this point, apparently, Chris Tapp has decided to give up his friend Ben Hobbs, who had been arrested in Nevada on a charge of assault rape involving a bladed weapon. Furman again told Tapp that an individual had informed law enforcement that a conversation was overheard between him, Tapp, and Hobbs getting or keeping their stories straight in a bedroom after the death of Angie. That would be the aforementioned Miss Osborne, who perjured herself on the witness stand during the trial of Chris Tapp by claiming to have overheard at a party the two of them conversing about the murder. At the time, by her own admission, she was tweaked on methamphetamine. And of course, she could not have overheard a conversation in which Hobbs admitted to participating in the murder because he wasn't on the crime scene. On January 10th, the day that Christopher Tapp gave this written statement supposedly confirming the role of Ben Hobbs as the murderer, Tapp was first put through a polygraph exam. At the end of the first exam, Detective Finn informed Tapp that he is showing a strong reaction when he is asked if he had killed Angie. Detective Finn continues telling Tapp that he has some involvement in the murder of Angie. Detective Finn began to interrogate Tapp and asked if he killed Angie or if he knew who killed Angie. Robeson comments, "The polygraphist should not be involved in the interrogation of a suspect. Detective Finn should have reported to the in-charge detective Tapp's polygraph results." While he is asking Tapp these questions, Tapp is still connected to the polygraph machine. "This is an unethical interview practice." I would use the word criminal. Detective Finn then informed Tapp that being an accessory is just like committing the crime, and then expressed to Tapp that he, Tapp, could get life in prison or even the gas chamber. After being polygraphed, or actually being put through the charade of being polygraphed, Detective Furman entered the room and Tapp told him, "It bothers me. I never thought that he would do it." At this point, Tapp told Detective Furman that Hobbs had told him that he, meaning Hobbs, went to Angie's that night. Hobbs told Tapp that he killed Angie. Both Detective Finn and Furman pushed Tapp to be more descriptive as to the details Hobbs told him about the murder of Angie. Tapp is telling Detectives Finn and Furman that he is done talking and wants to go home. He wants to leave. Detective Finn tells Tapp that he is not leaving until he finished telling them what happened in Angie's apartment. If they have the evidence to charge him, they can detain him. If they don't have the evidence to charge him, they cannot. Tapp told Detectives Finn and Furman, I didn't go with them. At this point, of course, he's suggesting that there was not merely Hobbs, but another perpetrator. After this statement, Tapp said he was done talking and wants to go home or leave. He is told by Detective Finn, Detective Furman had left the room, that he can't leave. You're not going to be able to go home until you tell the rest of inaudible. From the above statements by Tapp, comments Robeson, it appears that Detective Finn's refusal to allow Tapp to leave has made this an involuntary statement. It was on that day that he wrote the statement that supposedly incriminated Hobbs. Detective Furman began to educate Tapp on DNA evidence. "It is evident by his statements to Tapp that DNA was found at the crime scene. He told Tapp that DNA can be found in head hair and or pubic hairs." Detective Furman, comments Robeson, is revealing more details of the crime and evidence that was collected at Angie's apartment. This added to the contamination of any statements Tapp might make about evidence left at the scene. Tapp was finally allowed to leave and he promises to return the next day. That's following his written statement, reciting to them what they had prompted him to say about Ben Hobbs. Saturday, January 11th, 1997, Tapp failed to show up at the Idaho Falls Police Department as he had promised. Detective Furman went to his mother's home and tried to contact him. While speaking with Tapp's mother, she informed Detective Furman that Tapp had retained an attorney and that he, Tapp, and the attorney would be in contact with them on Monday. Idaho Falls detectives chose not to wait until Monday and instead obtained a warrant of arrest. Tapp was arrested later that day for accessory to murder and rape. After Tapp was abducted, I think that's the proper expression here, he was arrested because he was exercising his right to be represented by an attorney. Detective Furman, who had been told to wait for Tapp's attorney, didn't wait. He proceeded questioning Tapp without the presence of his attorney. There is a note by Robeson that the first portion of the interview was later suppressed by the courts. That's evidence that was deliberately withdrawn from the record, that is most likely exculpatory. Tapp expressed to Detective Furman that he should have done this earlier. Detective Furman responds with, "Well, not only that, but I want you to seriously think what I told you in the car, okay?" In a footnote, Robeson notes, Detective Furman should not have been discussing any of the case facts with Tapp at this point, as he, Tapp, is now represented by an attorney. What they talked about in the car is never disclosed. That is also missing evidence that is most likely exculpatory. Tapp's attorney and Idaho Falls Deputy Prosecuting Attorney John Schinderling are in the interview room along with Tapp and Detective Furman. Deputy Prosecuting Attorney Schinderling told Tapp he wants more details from Tapp concerning what Ben Hobbs related to him about the murder. Furman asked Tapp during this interview, "Why was the crime so sick? What was sick about it, Chris?" This is followed with Tapp saying that Hobbs told him he cut her a lot over and over, which is something that had been said previously. January 11, 1997, pages 37 to 38, interview transcripts. Detective Furman explained to Tapp that Angie was butchered. He compared Angie's murder to the O.J. murder, one with a lot of aggression and more than one stab or slice. In other words, he's reciting something Furman had told him earlier in the presence of Deputy Prosecutor John Schinderling. Detective Finn started the polygraph exam warning Tapp that he, Detective Finn, knows Tapp was at the homicide scene. He didn't know any such damn thing. And as a polygrapher, he's not supposed to be interrogating a witness, and he certainly should not be acting as an accuser. During this polygraph session, one of the questions Detective Finn asked Tapp was, okay, did you see Angie Dodge's body in her apartment on the floor before the murder was reported? Tapp is given this information, Angie being on the floor, several times during this exam. There is no mention of Angie Dodge being found on the floor in any prior recorded interviews with Tapp that I found. Detective Finn should not have advised how the body of Angie was discovered. At this point begins the systematic corruption of Tapp's memory, feeding him non-public details about the crime scene, about the condition of the victim, about the method of the murder, and so forth. And all those details were later used against him in court. And John Schinderling, who was present for much of this contamination, would later, in the summation of the prosecution's case, tell the jury that there's no way that Tapp could have known these details unless he had been the murderer. And Mr. Schinderling, who went on to become a district court judge, certainly knew better. I'll be back in just a minute. Lawyer representing Christopher C. Tapp on trial for murdering Angie Dodge took a day to present his client's defense, related the Post Register from Idaho Falls on May 27th of 1998. Robert L. Booker put five witnesses on the stand Tuesday, three of whom tried to establish an alibi for Tapp on the night of June 12, 1996, through the following morning. The prosecution's case took 7 days. 7 days to put on the prosecution, 1 day for the defense, and Bonneville County District Attorney Kip Manwaring had actually chewed up some of the trial time with a gratuitous and I think vindictive motion to deny the defense an opportunity to present an alibi. He filed a motion in limine against alibi evidence. Despite a videotaped confession by Tapp, his attorney has said repeatedly that his client was not involved in the murder and that Tapp has an alibi. On Tuesday, Jason M. Hope, a friend of Tapp's, testified Tapp attended a party at his mobile home the night of the murder. Tapp came over between 6 and 7 p.m. and left at about 10:30 or 11 p.m. with a woman named Brittany Morgan. Hope said he was certain the party was June 12th because it was one of the only days that month when he didn't have family commitments. "He was at my home," Hope said of Tapp under cross-examination. Hope also said he went to Tapp's apartment the next morning and talked to him about the previous night. Tapp said his girlfriend was upset because she found him with Morgan, according to Hope. The interesting point here is that Tapp was seen crying on the morning following Angie Dodge's murder, and some people have suggested that that was the product of a bad conscience, when actually it was the result of a breakup with his girlfriend over his dalliance with another woman. Morgan testified she was not certain when she went to Tapp's apartment. She knew it was in June, but could not pin it down to a specific date. Tapp's girlfriend, Ashley Washburn, then testified she found Morgan at Tapp's one morning when she stopped by on the way to a softball game. Washburn said she could place the day it happened because her family was preparing for a garage sale on June 14th, and her mother was in Denver the following week. I was pretty certain it was the morning of the 13th, she said. That's enough to establish reasonable doubt. Two rebuttal witnesses for the prosecution who went with Washburn to Tapp's apartment said they thought the events Washburn described happened on June 20th, not June 13th. Christine Weinkoff testified she knew what day it was because her boyfriend at the time, Travis Estes, came to her softball game with roses to mark the day they started dating. Weinkoff and Estes said they went to Tapp's apartment after the game at around 12:30 p.m. At the time, I should point out, Christine Weinkoff had an underage drinking charge hanging over her head that was subsequently dismissed. I suggest that might have constituted leverage. It is now up to the jury to decide if Christopher C. Tapp murdered Angie Dodge, reported the Post-Register on the following day, May 28th of 1998. Judge Ted V. Wood issued final instructions to the jury Wednesday, and then attorneys on both sides of the case made their closing arguments. Wednesday's closing arguments provided the lawyers with their last chance to sway the jury. John J. Schinderling, Chief Deputy Prosecutor for Bonneville County, gave a litany of details about the crime scene that Tapp correctly identified for police. In the previous segment, recall, I pointed out that he was present and he witnessed the systematic contamination of Tapp's memory by Detectives Furman and Finn and their comrades. Among other things, Schinderling said Tapp told police what Dodge was wearing. She was wearing sweatpants and a t-shirt, which of course is standard attire for a warm June evening. What room she was found in, that was something that was told to him by Furman, and he was actually taken to the crime scene in a visit that was not recorded or memorialized in any way. That she was raped, that's another piece of information that was provided to him by the investigators, and about a cut on Dodge's right breast. That's something that was not confirmed by the physical evidence. He had said, under prompting by Furman, that he had lifted her shirt and cut her breast. The incision was actually made through the clothing, so he didn't get that detail right. No one makes up a story and gets all the details, Schinderling said. Of course, you get all the details if they're fed to you by the investigators who are trying to frame you. But Booker stressed the lack of any physical evidence, like fingerprints, that would have proved that Tapp was in Dodge's apartment. None of the evidence matches Hobbs, who may or may not have been involved in the murder, he said. The only things linking Tapp to the crime are his own statements, Booker said. If he had simply kept quiet, Tapp would not be on trial. Tapp gave the police more details about the murder as they divulged more facts to him during the interrogation sessions. He was tricked into being at this defense table, Booker summarized. At one point during his closing argument, Booker seemed to cry, said that he could offer no explanation for his client's confession. I wish I had a good explanation, he said. We have that explanation now. He was essentially tortured into making a false confession. Instead, Booker asked the jury to imagine being subjected to prolonged and intense questioning by police. Booker also reminded the jury of Tapp's alibi. Tuesday, witnesses testified that Tapp was at a party the night Dodge was murdered and then brought a woman he met at the party home with him. Booker then reminded jurors of the testimony of Tapp's roommate, who said that on the night of the murder, Tapp came home around 3 a.m. with a red-headed woman. Prosecutor Kip Manwaring replied in his rebuttal, and the prosecution always gets the last word, Prosecutor Kip Manwaring said two other witnesses testified that the events described by Tapp's alibi witnesses actually took place a week after Dodge's murder, and that Tapp gave police no alibi when they questioned him in January of 1997. The latter, of course, is not dispositive, and the former is not all that compelling in light of the fact that they could not offer specifics. The alibi witnesses could offer specifics. In any case, what you have here is abundant reasonable doubt. About a week ago, I was contacted by a friend of mine who worked for KID Radio in Idaho Falls at the time of the Angie Dodge murder. He's somebody who knew the police department very well, and most of the people who were involved in the investigation were professional associates of his. He was a witness on the night of the murder. He was out walking on I Street in Idaho Falls near the temple with his then wife when he saw a suspicious-looking vehicle that was casing the apartment where the murder took place. He contacted Detective Ruse, Steve Ruse, who was investigating the case at the time. He was chief of detectives for the IFPD and said that he wanted to provide evidence. Ruse wasn't interested in the evidence that he had to provide regarding the make and model of the car and the occupants, plural, of that vehicle. Detective Ruse later was promoted to become chief of police. Apparently now he's in American Samoa, administering the Self-Reliance Center for the Perpetual Education Fund of the Mormon Church. He resigned suddenly in October 2012, and afterwards spent a few years teaching English for the Mormon Church education system in Brazil. Just a year before his resignation, he'd either turned down or had been passed over for a job as police chief in Provo, Utah, and at that time he said he planned on staying put in his position as chief of police at the Idaho Falls Police Department. This might be significant because in September 2012, 1 month before then-Chief Ruse's unexpected resignation, Christopher Tapp's attorney, John Thomas, filed a Brady motion containing affidavits by two people who had seen Jeffrey Lynn Smith near the site of the murder on the night of the murder, and he displayed all the indicia of having been involved in some kind of a desperate struggle, including abrasions on his face and blood on his clothing. In November of 2007, Tapp filed his motion for a new trial. That same month, the then-mayor of Idaho Falls, Jared Furman, who was the lead investigator, the lead interrogator, the lead torturer of Chris Tapp, asked for and received the resignation of Police Chief J. Kent Livesey, who had been the chief of police during the Angie Dodge murder investigation. And after Tapp's appeal gained traction, Furman suddenly developed incapacitating memory problems and resigned from his office. In May 2014, John Schindlerling, who had been the deputy prosecutor who made the summation argument, invoking all these details that had been force-fed to Tapp in an interrogation session that he had witnessed, unexpectedly resigned from his position as a district court judge in Idaho's 7th Judicial District. Now, one of my rules of reasoning is that one odd development is an anomaly. Two odd developments of that kind may be considered a coincidence, but three or more constitute a pattern. Here we have at least four of the principal people involved in the tainted investigation of the Angie Dodge murder and the wrongful conviction of Chris Tapp, who were in positions of responsibility, suddenly making themselves scarce. And just in the last 2 days, the Bonneville County Prosecutor's Office has produced a report that is a splendid specimen of the modified limited hangout strategy. Admit what is irrefutable, obfuscate what has yet to be proven, and then use all the dilatory tactics in your arsenal to run out the clock. At this point, the only reason why Christopher Tapp remains in prison is to protect the filthy, despicable people who put him there and who really should be there in his place. Thank you for joining me this week on Freedom Zealot Radio. Please join me online at freedominourtime.blogspot.com. I will return in a week, and until then, as always, dum spirito pugno, while I breathe, I fight. Good night, God bless, and maybe send the state back to the hell that spawned it.
What do you want to do now, Captain?
The same thing we always do. Fight him until we can't.